Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari.
And you're listening to The Coast.
To Coast.
Bio.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, so we are a little late in our recording. So although hopefully by the time people will hear this, it'll be at the usual sometime on Wednesday time.
Yeah, it's been a busy week, so let's see. But there's quite a few stories on our delicious inbox, I see.
As usual, but definitely. The first one in there that we'd like to talk about is sort of a continuation of something we discussed last week, which was this whole Embrace registry and service-based registries in general. And basically, Duncan, I found the story on Dunkel's blog all about various service registries in the life sciences. And he starts off by quoting Tim Bray, where he basically calls registries a waste of time. Tim Bray does. The impression I got was that Duncan didn't quite agree with him. And, you know, as somebody who's a practicing scientist, I sort of wanted to ask you what your opinion was on service registries as a way of discovering information and so on. And also partly because this was somewhat top of mind because I met John Musser, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, last week. Actually had lunch with him. John's the person who started Programmable Web, which is how I found Embrace in the first place, because I had blogged about how Programmable Web did not list enough biomedical mesh APIs, and that's how we ended up getting connected and how I ended up finding Embrace in the first place. So I was just wondering what your opinion on service registries in general was.
Well, personally, I don't use many service registries since I don't write many applications. And, well, let's put it this way. If you're a bioinformatician, obviously these are your bread and butter. You are, I guess, using these services entirely to a significant extent. The question I'd like to counter ask is how much of bioinformatics is still done using, say, you know, a manually constructed query, and then you just parse all the results after a file dump or something?
I would say most of it is still done like that.
Exactly. And I think service registries are a great thing. If I had the time, I would really, you know, learn how to, like, you know, APIs like eQuery and so on. They're very powerful, but the only time I did try to use a service registry, the problem I ran into was that the documentation and the it was using SOAP, and SOAP is quite a heavy kind of protocol to, I guess, interact with the web service.
And all the things, and so on. Yeah.
Right. And things kept changing. And every time you would write a particular, you know, function, it was either deprecated or there was all sorts of issues. Anyway, that apart, I think service registries are a great thing. And something like Embrace, which I guess lists a whole bunch of service registries and tries to bring them together into a framework like Taverna. Now, I haven't used Taverna either, but the idea, I guess, is to form this big collection of web services and then have people come in with workflows in the Taverna project.
That's what my experiment is all about, right? It's basically place. Yeah, it's a place. And I mean, in an ideal situation, you would be able to call, I think you can do that today, call sort of all those workflows with an API and connect workflows to each other or call components. You know, right now, I mean, I was thinking of sort of Pipeline Pilot when this discussion, actually John and I talked about my experiment, but where you can basically, you create your workflow and you dump it as an XML file and it has various components. It would be great if there was this collection of components available that you could create sort of workflows on the fly. You know, there's a great value to graphical pipelining and so on and so forth, but I think there's even a greater value, and you could still have a graphical pipeline, but you sort of have web-based where you are not limited to one application interface, but you can call a component from here, component from there, and start, you know, mashing them up together. And
Embrace is, I guess, an umbrella for a lot of these web services, right?
Well, there's the Embrace registry, and you also pointed out the whole Embrace.info side, which I think is a bigger mass. The BioSapiens,
right.
Yeah, which is like way beyond that, and we need to dig into that further in a separate podcast. There's so much in there, I don't think I've had time to really dig into it.
Yeah, same here. But I think web services are phenomenal. And actually, the one that you pointed me out to, that is really nice. That's a question I've asked many times. And this is Atom's blog post, which was talking about, does my sequence have, what was it? Have a new homolog.
Yeah.
And as a crystallographer, this is a question you ask many times. Or I would pose it slightly differently. Am I close to getting scooped? Well, but yeah, who wrote this web service, Atom?
I'm trying to remember. It came out of, I'm just going back to my blog post. This comes out of PDB alert. Comes to mind. Let me click on that link quickly. PDB alert. Comes from some group at the Max Planck. I don't know the people quite that well. I have a new post on complaining about somebody, about something that Pierre Baldi did. But this one comes out of, can't tell. It's tubingen.max, but it's Max Planck.
Cool.
I guess this is the papers, the PI is Schoeding, or somebody like that. So that's where it comes from. It was really something that at Geneformatics, you know, a lot of what we did was predict the structures of unknown, try and predict function of unknown, new structures that were coming out of the structural genomics projects. And this is like 8 years ago when they were just starting to churn out these structures, and there are so many unknown sequences. And we had modeled pretty much everything that we could get our hands on. And so we used to monitor every week and try and see if a new structure had been released which matched up one of the sequences that we'd built models for and had annotated. And we try and compare our models with the actual structure and see what was happening. So that was kind of a week. You know, we had our Perl scripts which did exactly something like PDB alert, but they were very manual cron jobs.
Maybe we should tell them what PDB alert does.
Yeah. So I definitely like that. I think what would be great was that if you could essentially do what we were doing in our system, which was, when you did that, we went in and manually looked at it, but it'd be great if you had wanted to connect that up to our function prediction system also, which would automatically test the new PDBs and see if, especially if they were not annotated, or if they were, try and see what the annotation was and see if these things matched up. Because if you have a structure, you know, oh, I have a new homolog, and by the way, here's a known set of functions for these, and mash them up.
Right.
You know, that's where I think having multiple services works really well, because you don't have to have, my lab has to come up with all the things that tell me everything about this protein. You can, you know, focus on a few areas of interest and use other resources. It always drives me mad that there's a 500 prediction servers, all of which give you essentially the same result.
Yeah,
so.
But this was nice, because this was, a quick, I guess it was fairly easy to come up with this algorithm that does this. The PDB alert, all they're doing is looking at, a structure, if you give them a particular sequence, they alert you when there's structures out there deposited in the PDB that are close to your sequence, right?
This one is pretty simple, but it's also very useful. I think that's always good.
Right. And interestingly, speaking of web services, I had this problem last week about CAS IDs and PubChem IDs. And it was really nice after a post on friend feed, Rajarshi Guha quickly hacked together, I would imagine, a web service or a REST URL is more like it. And I used it quite a lot to get quite a few CAS IDs from my PubChem CIDs. So it's a great way, I guess, for people to interact with bioinformatics programs that you've written, is just expose it as you don't even need a web service or a fancy SOAP bound registered service, but just as a REST URL, and you can just have other people query it, publish it somewhere, and it's such a neat model to expose your code and have other people use it, instead of giving them the code, having them run it. or building this nice web interface. You just have a REST URL, send it out, and people can just start using it. It's a very nice way. And I think web services are here to stay. Like, I wrote a little bit of XML RPC code, and it's such a lean, mean protocol that it's really fun to design web services now. In fact, before I even like think of developing a program, I think in terms of like the URLs that I could map my methods to. So it's really fun.
I rest my case.
Exactly. Yeah. I think things like Embrace Grid are like amazing things, and they're here to stay.
Talking about REST URLs, we definitely need to get a hold of Eric and Eric's paper. So it's not on our list today because I think we both have to dig into it. But Eric Jain put this up on Nature Proceedings, essentially is a paper, pretty long one, on the design decisions and the architecture of UniProt. And a whole section that on that is about URI design. On URI structures, why they chose the URIs the way they did, why, you know, what is the logic behind it. And then it's all REST-y. I think you will really, really appreciate that.
That's very nice. And another comment we had in probably episode 2 was how unresty NCBI PubMed is.
That was me.
But actually, that's quite a misconception. If you go to the PubMed main page and look at their help docs, they have a lot of REST URLs. In fact, you can...
Yeah, I actually did that after you told me that, and I have to agree that it's come a long way.
It's come a long way.
Yeah.
The PDB even has... You know, to get a file for PDB, for example, you just go to rcsb.org/PDB/PDB ID, and you can get the whole file.
Hang on, let me do that while we are waiting. So what is it? rcsb.org/PDB/PDB ID. So let me try 1C3W, my favorite protein, which is bacterial rhodopsin. I don't get it.
Oh, sorry. PDB/data/1OTS.
Okay.
Sorry. All right. It's somewhere. I always forget the exact structure, but
yeah. Actually, that it'll might, come to that, me. That might be working because it's getting me something. Anyway, it didn't work, but I'm sure I can. I'll track it down. So. I'm sure they have sort of nice. Because that's the kind of URI structure you want. Like, if you know what the URI structure is. Because I remember at Accelerus, we had these URIs that we had to put in to fetch, which using the CGI scripts that you had to change. And the PDB used to keep changing their URI structures, which was always used to end up breaking things. So,
especially... So, I guess...
Yeah. Anyway. So, yeah, I think we are all agreed that... PDB REST URIs are nice, and web services are sort of here to stay. So it'll be good if we can, if this becomes more common and this whole paradigm of downloading and parsing and all goes away. You know, and I think your experience with Rajarshi has demonstrated how useful this can be.
Right. So the REST URL for the PDB. Is rcsb.org/pdb/files and just give the PDB ID after that.
Got it.
Yeah. And this works for all of it. And remember I was talking about playing with Mathematica?
Yeah.
In Mathematica, you can actually pull files, inside of Mathematica, including PDB files, and display them and do all sorts of small, calculations and so on. And it was very nice because I could just use these REST URLs and I have this array of PDB files that I'm rotating and visualizing in parallel in Mathematica. It's a lot of fun.
So Mathematica has a PDB viewer built into it?
It has PDB. Yeah, it has a PDB viewer built into it. It has like small molecule viewers. Basically, it is... It has a lot of pre-built data sets, and it does full OpenGL graphics.
Yeah, the OpenGL, it's always done for a long time.
So you can do, like ribbon diagrams and ball and stick and lines and all that now inside of Mathematica.
In fact, I downloaded the Mathematica player, and what I was playing around with was this demonstration of spherical harmonics, so quantum chemistry stuff.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
Yeah, and that's what we used to use it in graduate school. My boss was a huge Mathematica fan, and all his quantum type orbital classes and QM stuff that he used to teach used to be done inside Mathematica, and all our spectra were done he used to do inside Mathematica. Uh-huh. He had written routines to do everything from infrared spectra, UV vis spectra, all of that. No programs, all Mathematica. I mean,
wow, that's a lot. That's intense. Yeah. I hope to get there someday.
Yeah. So anyway, moving off this topic, did you notice that as I blogged Big Data Meet Tech, Matt Wood is now guest blogging for the O'Reilly Radar?
That is exciting. Yes, I saw that. And I read his introductory post.
Yeah. He structured his introductory post just right, just sort of as an introduction to where things are, what sort of laying the landscape, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he will blog about in the future. What I especially like is that in places like the radar and so on, sort of the mainstream tech world, when people discuss life sciences, it's all this futuristic stuff, you know, bionic people, you know, cognitive intelligence and so on. This is like real.
Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah, this is real in the trenches, what people are doing things, right, rather than, you know, even 23andMe and all that, which have, they're cool. It's interesting science. I would rather people blog about genotyping and what makes those microarrays that useful for science, regular science. I hope Matt actually blogs about that a little bit at some point, you know, on especially related to 23andMe and Navigenics. So what a GWAS study is, what doing it on a microarray is, and how might it differ if you did it on using data from a next-gen sequencing instrument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very encouraging because most engineers who don't get biology tend to like latch on the Ray Kurzweil kind of perspective, as you said.
It's not just a Ray Kurzweil. I mean, it's what people like, you know, it's a Wired magazine approach. You know, Wired is cool and that, but the coverage of the life sciences can be, with a few exceptions, borders essentially on really geeky, futuristic-y, sci-fi-ish stuff rather than the really, really cool, real stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And there's enough cool stuff happening. And I think what people realize is how complicated, lose in all that, is how complicated biology is, how fast it is really advancing, and what are the real sort of real-world challenges, you know, that you face on a day-to-day basis in pharma or in academia.
Exactly. Yeah, it's great. I'm really looking forward to Matt's posts on the radar.
Yeah, so that'll be great. And so sort of going on to our next topic, which sort of almost goes back to our first one. I've really started spending a lot of time on Nature Proceedings lately. I love the UI. It's actually very easy to. I just like the layout and everything. So they had this PDF of a site that I'd actually seen a long time ago, and that reminded me about it. The paper is called Searching the World Wide Web Using Nucleotide and Peptide Sequences, and basically it describes a service called InstaSeq from Georgetown. It comes out of Richard Squire's group, I think. And basically what you do with InstaSeq is you can put in a sequence and essentially you can search by using a sequence. I think the first one I put in there was Elvis Lives. Or you can look for a PDB structure based on a sequence. So I entered like the first 20 amino acids of bacteriodopsin, and it gave me a bunch of hits for that. Although it didn't give me the PDB, it gave me some Japanese site. But it's almost like this very subject-specific search engine. It's kind of like PubMed is for publications, but this is specifically for phrases that are biologically relevant. So RNA sequences, nucleotide and peptide sequences. And I was wondering how valuable something like that was for you, and how you would expect the results to actually come out.
I think it's, I used it quite a lot actually after you bookmarked it. This thing is very, very useful. And the reason is very often, you know, even something like an accession ID, right? Every sequence has like 10 or 20 accession IDs, and looking for finding your particular sequence is a nightmare, unless, you know, you already have it bookmarked or something like that. Whereas on InstaSeq, I tried various permutations of this protein I work on, and it could pull up the exact sequence every single time.
Oh, that's great. Now,
Of course, you know, one of the times, even Google could pull it up. So this is built on top of Google, but they are doing a lot of very cool kind of intelligent parsing of your query string, I guess, to actually return something that's biologically meaningful and relevant.
Well, the first thing they do is a Boolean, right? If you enter a sequence in, they do a bunch of ORs on it. Have you noticed that?
Sorry, your audio was breaking up. I didn't hear you.
So if you add a particular sequence snippet on it, it actually does an OR and looks at various combinations.
Right.
Yeah. So does it.
And I'm sure even the mass spec people or even, you know, peptide sequencing people, right? This should be really cool because it also looks at like a small kind of blast of your query sequence. You can give a snippet of a sequence and find the files that snippet could possibly be in. And it's very, very fast. The architecture is quite cool. I all the results it was returning were like instant, almost, you know, as fast as Google. So it is a very useful service. And in fact, I've used it in the last week several times to find sequences just based on various accession numbers, and it finds them every single time.
Yeah, what would be cool was if we had sort of this generic thing that we can put into our Firefox toolbar or something, you know, sort of search bar to look for primers, look for your sequence information, all kinds of interesting sort of things. I think there was something like that earlier, sort of like a meta engine, but that was just searching various different databases. This one, I think, is a more generic one.
Correct.
That pulls out interesting information about your sequence.
Yeah, and I haven't read the proceedings article yet, but I'm imagining the architecture is quite impressive because of how fast the whole thing runs.
Yeah, no, so I mean, I'm definitely hoping to see more such search engines come up and, you know, or see the growth of something like InstaSeq, how it goes, how it scales, how many people use it. I mean, PubMed's become such the default, I think.
Right.
And Google, it's basically, I think, most of us search stuff using PubMed and Google, right?
Exactly.
That's the combo. So it's, in fact, one way, I don't know if Google allows that, one way to do that would be using something like GreaseMonkey. And
yeah,
actually running InstaSeq as a GreaseMonkey extension of Google. It should be doable, right? Little JavaScript snippet that make InstaSeq a user script at userscripts.org. And when you enter your search query into Google or PubMed, maybe it actually does InstaSeq search or gives you at least InstaSeq results as sort of one of these plus boxes or something like that. I think that might be the best way to go forward with something like that.
Yeah, so you don't hijack Google, but actually supplement, right?
Yeah, I mean, it keeps you within the search engine that you're using all the time.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely, I mean, there
we
are...
We should do, like, you know, what's that, that Firefox toolbar, right? I used to use that quite a lot.
Yeah, that's the one I was talking about.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called, but it was very good to launch searches from. But now I just use PubMed all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you just get used. You don't want to jump around too much. I mean, I think that's one of the challenges. Even something as nice, that's a different use case. Like NextBio gives you different types of information because it's a really, really powerful search engine as well. So what else do we have on our list today?
Git.
So this comes from Rich Apodaca, who's a chem informatician based in San Diego. And obviously, for the CDK project and other things, Egon Villigagen's been using Git extensively, GitHub, where the code is stored. But Rich had this blog post where he said, goodbye Subversion, hello Git and GitHub. And he's taken some of his, you know, chem informatics projects onto there. And he sort of had a nice blog post after the one I have on Delicious, where he talked about one of the net advantages of GitHub, which is that cool network graph that shows you who's forked your code, when they check things back in, all of that, and it's graphically represented. So it sort of builds a social network, not around people, but around code. Sort of a code network, which is kind of neat, right? And I think what I've started to see is definitely in the Ruby and Ruby on Rails community, GitHub has become sort of the ground zero, if you can use that word. And with, I guess Rich comes from a Ruby side, but Jan Ayers also has bio, I forget what his code is. He's put stuff in GitHub. Matt Wood put stuff in GitHub. But even things like BioRuby are hosted on GitHub. So the Ruby community is definitely adopted it, but then Egon doesn't write in Ruby and he still has GitHub as well. So I'm starting to see, you know, maybe this is a what we're going to start seeing is Git and GitHub becoming sort of these default place to do scientific projects. And, you know, I really like both services. I know you've been looking into them. So it's good to see sort of them becoming more popular with all kinds of developers.
And I think the great thing you said was the social network around code, right? That's so powerful for, like, for someone like me who's wanting to learn code, like just to see the kind of ways that people are thinking about a particular problem.
Yeah.
And Git allows you to do that because you could, or GitHub especially, where you can follow a fork and see what, you know, what a particular approach that one particular fork is employing versus the other. And you can compare them and see the exact algorithm they use to solve something.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I haven't used GitHub extensively, but I've just started using Git and I can't wait to, you know, actually start getting familiarized with GitHub. Are there like screencasts and stuff that tell you?
In fact, GitHub is all about screencasts. And the Git.
Oh, great.
There's a whole website called Gitcasts. And
oh,
also,
is there?
Yeah, Gitcasts. Just Google Gitcast. And I think Sean Chacon and even Railscasts, there's a whole Railscast on how to use Git and GitHub, I think, somewhere. I think the GitHub website might have some screencast. I mean, that whole community is big on screencasts in general. In the whole Rails community, there's a new Learn Rails in 15 Minutes video screencast out. I mean, the thing that, write a blog in 15 minutes, what made Rails famous in the original.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, in that the first place. Yeah.
Was that DHH who did that screencast
or somebody else? The original one was D2H. This new one is Ryan Bates, who does Railscasts. It's good. It's slicker than D2H's, but it loses some of that personality that David has. He's got an interesting personality. But yeah, so actually there's like this EC2 library, which has a fork on GitHub. And I haven't done it yet, but one of the reasons I'm watching both of them is to see how the two forks sort of work. And what are the differences and so on. If I ever write any useful code, that's exactly where it's going. All open source code is free on GitHub. Only if you are hosting private repositories do you have to pay.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
In fact, let me give myself this personal target. I've started... Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, I've started this Python PDB parser that... I decided to reinvent the wheel in an attempt to actually teach myself effective parsing.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll put it up on GitHub and just see if, even if somebody logs in and says, oh, this guy's code sucks.
No, that's my biggest fear. But I think you have to sort of overcome that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that'll be better than right now me looking at this code and saying, wow, this is cool.
Yeah, no, I definitely think, and you know, you always learn by looking. As somebody, I think, who said this? I think on Stack Overflow, Jeff Atwood said that all good programmers and designers are good at stealing. Ideas, you know, that's how you learn how to write code. I definitely think so. Anyway, we are reaching the 30-minute mark. So I think, especially given that it's a little later than we usually are, we can probably end here, but I think it's... we have a great point to end on, which is something that I'll let you take over because you're the practicing structural biology guru. And that's a blog post by Bosco called The 10 Commandments of Protein Folding. I figured you'd get a chuckle out of it.
Oh, it was hilarious, actually. This guy writes very, very, very well. Hold on. I seem to have lost my tab here and I can't remember most of his very effective prose. Just a second. Or why don't you start off and I'll find the...
Yeah, so basically, the blog post starts, channeled by his holy prophets, Xu Hua Feng and Bosco Ho in the year of the Lord 2004. And basically goes through 10 commandments. I'll say the first one is, thou shalt have no other structure before the one true native structure. Number two is, thou shalt not make unto thee any false structure of the native state, or any likeness of any structure such as predicted by molecular dynamics or homology modeling programs.
I was
cracked up right here.
The third one's awesome too. thou shalt not take the name of the native structure in vain, and call by it any structure of RMSD greater than 4 angstroms. For I, the Lord, thy God, is a jealous physicist, visiting the iniquity of the false believers of CASP upon their graduate students and postdocs, unto the third and fourth generation, and shewing mercy unto humble crystallographers that keep my commandments. I was literally like, I was like, oh, this stuff needs to go on my wall, right by all my crystal trays. But yeah, we'll put it up in the show notes, and you should just check out all the commandments.
Yeah, I mean,
commandment 6 reads, thou shalt not misfold. Commandment 7, thou shalt not aggregate. Commandment 8, thou shalt not commit adultery unto the wrong binding partner.
I actually liked the last one also a lot. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's structure as designated by scope or cath, nor his sequence, nor his function, for thy structure has been given thee by thy sequence alone. I think this is a structural biology in joke, so for all of you DNA people, we apologize.
The RNA people, I'm sure, will get it probably, but
I
yes,
don't know.
Exactly.
All these two-dimensional people. Real power comes with 3. That's 11th commandment.
Honor thy hydrophobic residues. Thou must bury them in thy core.
And as a membrane protein guy these days, I'm sure you disagree with that. Other way around.
Yes, yeah. All sorts of things go on there.
Yeah. Now, number 4 is something again that's very near and dear to my heart. Remember the free energy landscape. To keep it holy and always go downhill.
Anyway. In milliseconds, thou shalt sample confirmations, but by the 1,000th millisecond, thou shalt not labor. Thou, nor thy sidechains, nor thy backbones, nor thy disulfide bridges, nor thy binding partner that forms complex with thine active site. For in the 1,000th millisecond, the Lord placed thee in the free energy minimum, and blessed thy the native state.
Yeah, perfect.
All right, this is great. Oh, cool. So I think I should be getting my new mic next week. So hopefully my audio quality will equal that of yours.
Yeah,
and
hopefully we'll have interesting stuff to talk about then also. And we are almost at our 35-minute mark. It's actually 32 or something like that. So let's, on that somewhat funny and geeky and structural biology-related note, this is Coast to Coast Bio signing off. This is Deepak and
Hari, and bye.
Talk to you next week. Cheers.